from the historic campus of Hillsdale College in Hillsdale, Michigan, where the good, the true, and the beautiful are taught, nurtured, and honored, this is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour, bringing the activity and education of the college to listeners across the country.
If you aren't curious about how a global pandemic started, willing to look into it and willing to talk to people who have different theories, you have not a single curious bone in your body, and you should really not be in journalism.
This is your host, Scott Bertram, and that's Molly Hemingway, our first guest on today's program. Molly is senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale, also a senior editor at The Federalist, a Fox News contributor, and more. We talked at length with Molly about journalism today and her forthcoming book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. More on that in a little bit. Find her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Molly, great to have you back.
It is wonderful to be here with you.
Want to talk a little about journalism today and some recent stories. There's a piece of The Federalist we'll return to in a little bit. It's important to be honest about what today's media actually are. We'll return to that question in a moment. But there's been, just in the past 2 weeks or so, so many stories that damage the credibility of our news media, as if that were still possible. The Brian Stelter interview on CNN with Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, is uniquely awful. If people did not see this, and it's on CNN, so they probably didn't, but the White House press secretary comes on for an interview, Brian Stelter, reliable sources, CNN, media critic. The very first question that he asks Jen Psaki is, what does the press get wrong when covering Biden's agenda? When you watch the news, when you read the news, what do you think we get wrong? It's usually a question you'd ask a boss. In this case, it's the White House press secretary being asked this question, and it's something you could never imagine, ever imagine, anyone asking any of President Trump's press secretaries. What do we do wrong? How can we do a better job covering your administration? That would simply never happen.
That is the precise issue, that it's not a question that you saw asked during the Trump administration. It's not a great question, obviously. It wouldn't necessarily be the worst question in the world if CNN and Brian Stelter had the same approach toward every press secretary, regardless of which administration they were in. But it wasn't just that they never asked anything like that of Kayleigh McEnany or the other press secretaries President Trump had. It's that they were cartoonishly hostile, never even giving a moment of good faith toward these press secretaries or anyone in the Trump administration. And then the moment Joe Biden is elected, it returns to what we saw during the Obama era of loyalty and fealty to these administration officials and a willingness to accept whatever they say and just a general niceness in how they treat these people. And it's not just that this is too nice for a legitimate journalist to be this way. It's also that it's in the context of just horrific hostility and crazy making and lying for year after year after year. And then when a Democrat is in office, it's exactly the opposite. And it's that approach that is untenable for a free people and a republic like ours.
If we throw into the mix now the lab leak story, Senator Tom Cotton, many others pilloried by the press, by the media, for bringing up the possibility that the COVID coronavirus could have been a lab leak in China. This is one of those stories that points to perhaps, in my mind, a total lack of curiosity on behalf of so many members of the media who are less likely to investigate, less likely to entertain things that simply don't conform to an existing narrative. Is there a problem with a lack of intellectual curiosity on behalf of many of our media members?
Scott, if you aren't curious about how a global pandemic started, one that has killed millions of people, sickened tens of millions more, utterly destroyed many major economies. I mean, this country, we are still down 7 to 8 million jobs since this began. If you're not curious about how that started and willing to look into it and willing to talk to people who have different theories, you have not a single curious bone in your body, and you should really not be in journalism. And it really shows how much people are willing to suppress that natural curiosity for partisan political aims. you know, they then also said that the reason why they messed up this story wasn't because of some personal failing, but because the theory had been talked about by Republican politicians like Mike Pompeo, Donald Trump, Tom Cotton, and so they just sort of reflexively opposed it. They took sources that were denying this like likelihood or strong possibility that the Wuhan Institute of Virology that was working on this coronavirus might have had something to do with it being unleashed on the world. They took certain sources and took them as more credible than the sources who were skeptical. And then they did this thing where they twisted what people were actually saying in order to debunk claims that weren't made. So they would say Tom Cotton was saying that China had engineered a biological weapon to unleash on the world. Well, he never said anything like that. He was saying, I think we need to look into the Wuhan Institute of Virology. But if you make the claim more dramatic than it was, it's easier to debunk it. So there were just multiple media failures here all across the board.
Molly Hemingway is with us here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Find her on Twitter at MZ Hemingway. Her piece at The Federalist from a couple of months ago now, but it still rings true, of course. It's important to be honest about what today's media actually are. The subhead says they are Democrat propagandists and should be treated as such. You write in here, assume out of the gate that the narrative these leftist activists are pushing is not true. I don't know when this happened for you. I will tell you very clearly when it happened for me was during the 2016 election, probably sometime in the middle of the year, probably after the nominees were essentially known, that any tweet, any report from the New York Times, Washington Post, ABC, NBC, CBS, I simply assumed was not true. I simply assumed that perhaps not the opposite was true, but what they were saying was not the entire story. In some ways, it made me a better media consumer because I had to go seek out original sources. I had to go find other points of view because I knew what was being reported was quite likely not going to be accurate. How should people deal with this assumption that the narrative is going to be contra what the truth is oftentimes?
First off, I just love hearing what it was that made people become better media consumers. And it's one of my favorite questions to ask people because you would be surprised at the wide variety of responses. And for me personally, it was the media treatment of Mitt Romney when he was running for president. Mm-hmm. I'm not even like a huge Mitt Romney fan, but he's such a nice guy. And the way they portrayed him as Hitler, I thought, if they're willing to do this with this guy, they're willing to do it with literally anyone that they perceive as a threat to their political interests. So I think it is a good step that most people actually understand. Studies show that there's not much trust in the media, and that's across the board. I mean, not even Democrats have that much trust. That's a good first step. But then the question is, what do you do? Do you still let them define the contours of the debate? Do you still read them and treat them as if they are legitimate? And I think that's a good next step for people. Don't call them mainstream media. They're not mainstream media, and they're propaganda for the most part. You might find a good journalist here or there who's willing to just report facts, but that's not what the general situation is with corporate media. And you need to stop relying on them for news or relying on them uncritically for news and stop supporting them and advertising with them and paying attention to them. And also, though, I think the big actors need to be a little bit more aware of what they need to do. So, for instance, if the media are no longer even trying to pretend to be caring about a shared set of facts but are just engaged in political activism, they should have no role in presidential debates. That's ludicrous to think that they would be considered to be moderators of any debate involving the party that they will do anything to support and the party that they will do anything to destroy. And powerful people like that need to stop treating them as if they are media when they're actually propagandists. Not a single conservative should go on one of these liberal networks or talk to a liberal newspaper without understanding that they are walking into a space where the people want to destroy them. Now, if they're prepared for that and they can handle that and they can work that to their advantage, that's one thing. But they shouldn't be acting like these people are operating in good faith when they have spent decades showing that they're not.
Molly, we'll pause right there when we come back. More on the state of journalism today and also a preview of Molly's forthcoming book, a couple of months away, but available for pre-order now. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. To find out more about Hillsdale College for prospective students, for friends of Hillsdale or alumni, head to hillsdale.edu. We've been talking with Molly Hemingway, Senior Journalism Fellow here at Hillsdale, also with The Federalist and a Fox News contributor, specifically about a recent piece for The Federalist titled, It's Important to Be Honest About What Today's Media Actually Are. I'm frustrated, and maybe others are too, by the aspect of accountability here. And there simply is none. You can go back to, we talked about the lab leak, the Lafayette Park story previously. One that sticks out very vividly from recent vintage is the 60-minute story on Ron DeSantis, where we know that they clipped out the entire portion of the governor's answer where he debunked the line of argument that 60 Minutes was making. We know that essentially it became a hit piece against the governor. And yet there are no consequences for the reporter. There are no consequences for 60 Minutes, for CBS. There is no apology. There is no retraction. There is nothing at all. It just hangs out there. And there are no consequences for these activities. Do you feel that is a deep source of frustration as well?
This is what is so, yes, frustrating about the current moment. You actually can go back to Eisenhower to find Republican presidents complaining about bias in the media. George H.W. Bush, when he ran for re-election, his bumper sticker that was most popular was, annoy the media, re-elect Bush. If you're still complaining about bias and not recognizing the absolute corruption of our media, you just belong back in the 1980s and not as a political actor in this state. You take 60 Minutes. I mean, when was it that Dan Rather made up reports on George W. Bush?
Right.
You can't keep forgetting what they do and how they lie about everything. And part of the problem is that I think a lot of conservatives have internalized this idea that they deserve to be treated like second-class citizens. And that's not true. And they need to not tolerate the willful lying and defamation and falsehoods that are happening routinely from corporate media. So you're seeing some people start to push back. I think Ron DeSantis is actually excellent. I heard him say at an event recently something about how the media don't like him, but that's okay because he doesn't like them either. He just understands they're out. They sense that he is a very powerful person who could continue to expose them for who they are, and so they're focused on bringing him down. He gets it, and so he engages with them like that, and he's smart enough that when he was smart enough not to cooperate in the 60 Minutes hit piece on him because he knew where that was going, and it actually redounded in to some extent to his benefit. But 60 Minutes is still powerful, and we need again more powerful people to push back against the daily lies and misinformation that they're putting out. There's so much disinformation that just happens routinely. You referenced the Lafayette Park thing that lasted for more than a year. That actually led to a lot of people being afraid to restore law and order in their cities. Like, if you couldn't defend the White House, you certainly can't defend, you know, Joe Bob's store that's getting burned down in Kenosha. Mm-hmm. You can't, and it led to so many deaths and billions of dollars of damage. This is a powerful political actor, and people need to treat the corrupt media like the powerful political actors they are. They're unaccountable. They never admit error. They're never forced to deal with the damage they cause, even when it's like actual death and billions of dollars of damage. And people need to, basically every single member, I would say, of the conservative movement and anyone who just cares about the Republic needs to aim decisively against corrupt media and the damage they're causing the country.
I've been kicking around a theory, Molly, that I'll share with you and get reaction in trying to explain what's going wrong, what's happening. And what I come up with is that a problem is that so many in the media give tweets the weight of stories, but they treat their stories as lightly as perhaps they should tweet tweets. Stories are ephemeral. It's wrong today. It's not a big deal. We'll write a different story tomorrow. But tweets are forever. You tweet the wrong thing, you can be canceled. You can be fired. Things from 10 years ago matter today, even if you're a completely different person. You were 14 back then. You're 24 right now. It seems like the weight is placed upon these tweets, these 200-character things as opposed to the stories. The stories can be wrong, whatever. But the tweet can't be wrong.
That is such an excellent insight that I hope you write it up and flesh it out a little bit more. I would only add to it, though, that it's not entirely true that it's universally applied. And I'm thinking about how in the last week we learned that Hunter Biden used racist language mm-hmm. in text, and I think foreign media reported on it. The U.S. media ignored it. But the U.S. media will put on the front page of the New York Times, just like what you said, a kid when she was 14 using the same word inappropriately and having her entire life destroyed. So there is such they don't even care that they're not applying the same standards across the board. If you're powerful and elite and with them politically, they will protect you at all costs. And if you are young, they will keep you in line. Or if you're young or disfavored politically, they will use the same things to keep them in line. But yes, the Twitter has been such a net negative for journalism, except that I think it has exposed just how lacking in intelligence and integrity many reporters are.
You might know Molly Hemingway from The Federalist or Fox News or here at Hillsdale, but of course also the author of the best-selling book Justice on Trial, The Kavanaugh Confirmation and the Future of the Supreme Court, co-author with Carrie Severino. There is a new book that is coming out soon, but people can find and pre-order your upcoming book, Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. Give our listeners a bit of a preview of what's to come in Rigged.
Yeah, I was just fascinated how people were talking about the election after it happened, where you got these two extreme positions. Either you were told that even though there had been radical changes to the way we conduct elections in terms of a massive increase in mail-in balloting, which has traditionally been associated with a lack of scrutiny or an opportunity for fraud, that this was the most pure and decent and best election in history, and anyone who says otherwise is a liar. And then on the other hand, you had people trafficking in some pretty extreme conspiracy theories about, you know, Venezuela taking over voting systems and things like that. The vast majority of Republican voters did not feel like this election was conducted in a completely free, fair way. And I wanted to look into that and looking at how there are many different ways they look at that, whether it was what we just have been talking about, corruption by the media, where they lied about President Trump or other Republican candidates or failed to cover stories that were critical of their opponents, polling that was seemingly so out of touch with reality that it was questionable about the effect it had on the election, such as saying that Donald Trump would lose Wisconsin by 17 points, as the Washington Post said just days before the election, and the final tally was less than 1%, or tech companies suppressing conservative information and thought, or these changes to election laws, which for me, what was most interesting is it allowed this very big liberal nonprofit, all these entities to kind of come into our electoral system. So I do a deep dive into all of this stuff and look at it and kind of separate out the crazy theories from what actually happened and looking at what needs to happen going forward.
That is coming up in Rigged, How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections, available for pre-order now from Molly Hemingway, senior editor at The Federalist, senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College, Fox News contributor. Find her also on Twitter at MZHemingway. Molly, thank you so much for joining us once again here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, Sohrab Ahmari will join us from the New York Post, whose book is The Unbroken Thread. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Hey, guys. Dave Ramsey here. Join me and the Ramsey personalities as we give you the tools and motivation you need to win in the areas of money, career, and more right here on The Ramsey Show. Listen weekdays at noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM, your talk radio station.
Hi, this is Matt. I'm your host of Liberty Unabashed, a new show on Sundays, 8 to 9. We're going to have some good music, some deep thought, and I hope you check us out.
Life is too short to be uninformed.
The Armstrong and Getty Show, 9 to noon on KCNR 96.5 FM and 1460 AM.
on over for savings at Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros in downtown Reading. Buy 5 car wash coupons and get one free. Or buy 10 and get 3 free. Quick and Clean is a family-owned business. They offer only the highest quality service. Quick and Clean Car Wash at the corner of Market and Eureka Way next to Dutch Bros in downtown Reading. Quick and Clean.
Your friendly oil change, Premier in all we do.
Premier Oil Change has been locally owned and operated since we opened in 2006, enjoying long-term relationships with our team members and loyal guests. Many of our team members have worked with us for over 10 years. Many of our certified technicians have logged over 30,000 oil changes, working on hundreds of different vehicle makes and models. In an ever-changing world, we strive to keep up with change. With our extensive training program, it's important to the staff at Premier Oil Change that our customers' cars are well taken care of by experienced, well-trained technicians. So you can depend on your vehicle to get you and your family to your destination. Don't forget that you can earn free oil changes with Premier Rewards. Learn more at PremierOilChange.com or visit us in Palo Cedro. Premier is in the Holiday Market Shopping Center or in Reading on Lake Boulevard next to Waterworks Park or our newest location in Anderson across from Roundtable. Remember, you get a free car wash with every oil change. Premier Oil Change, home of the friendly oil change.
This Hawaiian mini vacation is brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning. So what does professional office cleaning have to do with relaxing in a tropical paradise? Frankly, nothing. But Maui Bob and the crew want to remind you to be sure to take the time for what's important in this workaday world. Family, friends, and yes, even yourself. And if their professional office cleaning services can help you make that time, give them a call at 221-5868. This Hawaiian mini vacation was brought to your radio by Maui Bob's Office Cleaning, 221-5868.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. We're joined by Sohrab Amari. He's op-ed editor at the New York Post, a columnist over at First Things, a contributing editor at the Catholic Herald, and he has a brand new book out, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Sohrab, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
I want to ask at the beginning, the difference for you between knowledge and wisdom, as it says in your subhead of the book, how do you delineate those two, and why is wisdom more important?
I guess I would say knowledge is a subset of wisdom or a building block of wisdom, but it's not the sum of wisdom. I opened the book with a chapter about C.S. Lewis. The book as a whole is structured around 12 unasked questions that I argue our society doesn't pay attention to or mistakenly believes have been answered or have been cast aside by the rise of modern science or what have you, whereas in fact they're very pertinent questions. And each question is explored through the life of one great thinker, because I'm not a theologian or a philosopher, I'm just a storyteller and a journalist of ideas. And the first chapter has to do with precisely the question you asked. The figure at the center of it is C.S. Lewis and his critique of scientism. And it has to do with the difference really between the way I frame it, instead of knowledge and wisdom, is more about facts and truth. Hmm. It's only roughly the past 400 years in the kind of moral and intellectual history of our species that we came to equate facts with truth or facts with wisdom. And the danger in that is that all sorts of other dimensions of life that contain wisdom for us, for example, our premonitions, our feelings, religious thought, literature, poetry, all of these come to be treated as secondary or provisional or less important and unreliable. And so I argue that that impoverishes us as a people, as the American people, as moderns.
You mentioned each chapter here asks a question: is God reasonable? What do we owe our parents? And then answers it with a biographical sketch of a thinker on that topic. I just want to spend time on one other before we get to some bigger questions, and that's the chapter on Victor Turner. Can you be spiritual without being religious? How do you attack that question?
Yeah, Scott, as you probably have heard, about 20% of Americans now claim to be spiritual but not religious. That is, they believe they have some access to a spiritual realm that they can access on their own without the need for the traditional instruments and, more important, the rituals that we associate with religion, all kind of major religions, but also smaller ones. What I argue in that chapter is that the problem with spiritual but not religious isn't that it is the religion side of it, it's the spirituality side of the ledger, because traditional religions combine ritual with shared public meanings about the ultimate meaning of life. So, for example, when you go to church, you do certain ritualistic things. If you're Catholic, you cross yourself when you enter, you do certain things, you do a rite of penance at the beginning of the Mass, and so on and so forth. But then you share that with other believers and a faith in some ultimate meaning of life that you get from the Catholic faith or the Muslim faith or the Jewish faith. The people who claim to be spiritual but not religious do all sorts of ritualistic things. They do yoga on their own, or they go spinning, or they only eat, drink, you know, certain kind of restorative juices on Fridays or what have you. So they have the ritual aspect, or maybe the ritual of public singing on Twitter is a kind of ritual itself, but they don't have a shared account of ultimate meaning, and therefore their spirituality is unserious.
Sir Abba Mari is with us. The Unbroken Thread is his new book, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. I know you began work on this book a couple of years ago and put it to bed in the middle of 2000, if I'm not mistaken. You could not have predicted some of these things that have been happening between lockdowns and losing our ties to constitutional order, statues being torn down, history classes being rewritten on the fly to exclude certain lessons, certain people. We are becoming quickly untethered to these past traditions. Why does it seem that we are accelerating in this direction?
Well, that's a great question, Scott. So I should note that I wrote this book for my son. He's now 4 years old. When I started, which was before the pandemic, in the before times, he was 2 years old. And the reason I started writing it was because I was, you know, deeply worried, frankly, about what kind of a man our current civilizational arrangements would chisel out of him. What I'm worried about is that our civilization formed elites to be incredibly selfish and self-gratifying and self-seeking, and it makes it incredibly difficult for ordinary people to live decent, virtuous American lives as they used to do. That the world that came about was brought about in the name of liberation. The kind of left establishment and the right establishment together, without really asking the American people whether this is the world they wanted, gave us this world, and they promised to liberate us. They said that by overcoming our ancient traditions, our Judeo-Christian and classical traditions that informed American life, we would be freer and happier. Only in retrospect do we see that those traditions that guided people and restrained their appetites and told us that there is such a thing, for example, as objective truth about the differences between men and women, those traditions were not sources of oppression. That's what was keeping us free, sane, and happy. So the book is this defense of tradition in a broad sense, as what looks to be something that's restrictive is actually liberating.
I want to spend another minute on that, and if I just summarize the argument a bit, it's living within traditional limits can liberate us. Unending liberty in many ways imprisons us in a way. If that's true, that's a choice, though, a choice to continue to live within those traditional limits. How do you convince people to do that?
Well, I mean, part of it is the project of writing the book. For me as a father, it's an act of austerity for my son to try to inoculate him against what he'll be told, no doubt, in probably the schools he'll attend or our wider culture, to tell him that everything traditional is icky, and all your ancestors were basically morons, and everything new is best. Whatever is newest is best. It's kind of what C.S. Lewis called chronological snobbery or presentism. I'm trying to inoculate that as a father, but I also think that public policy plays a role. That is, traditionalist political actors, broadly speaking, and in our society, what tradition is a little bit more contested. We're a pluralistic society, but nevertheless, you can argue that an Orthodox Jew shares more with an evangelical Christian and with a devout Roman Catholic than either of them, and even a Muslim, and than either of them does with a kind of woke liberal. therefore, traditionalist political actors have to seek to restore some of these traditions, including enshrining them in law where they've been needlessly abolished. So one kind of provocative argument that I make is the restoration of the Sabbath as an American institution. So as you know, America had Sabbatarianism, with Sabbath laws, going to the colonial era, so before the founding of the Republic. In colonial New England, but also in supposedly more secular colonial Virginia, in New Amsterdam, the Dutch had. And what was that about? They told us that getting rid of it, and when I say they, I mean the kind of Chamber of Commerce establishment, right, told us getting rid of it would mean more choice, more freedom. You could do whatever you want with your time. And you don't have to be, as a religious person, you don't need a Sabbath. Well, in practice, that's not how it worked out. Because it turns out the Sabbath wasn't just about honoring God, as important that is, honoring him in his creation, in his gift of creation, and setting aside some time for non-acquisitiveness, non-competition, but more being with God, being with Scripture, being with family, but also protected workers. The institution of the Sabbath is a kind of barrier against relentless work, and the loss of it has made us more harried and more miserable.
Sohrab Ahmari, The Unbroken Thread is the new book, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos. Sohrab, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Scott.
Up next, we talk with Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department, returning for his occasional series on definition. Today we talk technical definition. I'm Scott Bertram. This is the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
This is Ted Leidy with Northern Firearms Instruction. With all the talk about gun control and stripping firearms rights from law-abiding citizens, I just want you to remember that our country was founded on the idea that we would each be accountable to ourselves and each other for the safety of our society. Another important responsibility we have is a safe and effective use of a firearm. If that is your choice, give NFI a call at 999-1822 or find and register for one of our popular CCW courses at usgunpro.com. Remember, it's our right and our responsibility.
Redding Electric Utility cares about the whole community, and we offer an income-qualified residential energy discount program that can save you up to $400 a year on your energy bill. And once per year, CARES bill credit up to $300. To find out if your income qualifies you for a residential discount program and CARES program, call 339-7200. That number again is 339-7200.
Where do you go in Shasta County to get advice on the best type of firearm to meet your needs and how to safely carry and use it? The answer is to join the revolution at locally owned Bastiani Arms. Bastiani Arms believes in a better way to serve their customers and providing them with all the information needed to make the right decisions before and after the sale. They have a large selection of guns and ammunition and always special discounts for veterans. Self-protection is your right. Join the revolution at Bastiani Arms, 2539 Larkspur Lane in Reading, 222-8222.
Greetings, North State. Just a reminder here to be sure and tune in to Common Ground Radio Saturday mornings at 9 o'clock. You know, we have much more in common with one another than we normally recognize, but fail to see this thanks to our polarized media that deliberately divides us and demonizes the other side. Common Ground Radio is your progressive call-in talk show for the North State, right here on Radio KCNR, where we seek bipartisan agreement on many issues affecting all of us, using respectful, fact-based dialogue and starting for change from the progressive side of the street.
Every Monday from 6 to 8 p.m., join us at Radio Wasteland, your local guide to the unexplained and the unknown. Each week, we cover all things unexplained, from the moving stars in the sky to the things that go bump in the night. Visit us as we explore these topics and more as our in-studio team digs deeper with featured guests and listener call-ins. Mondays are rough, but now your overworked brain has a chance for some sweet relief with Radio Wasteland.
Radio Wasteland, Mondays at 6 on KCNR.
Welcome back to the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. I'm Scott Bertram. You can get an email every time there's a new episode of the program. Head to radiohour.hillsdale.edu and enter your email address. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu. We also invite you to find the show on Twitter, at Hillsdale Radio. We're joined by Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College. Dr. Beyer, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Continuing our occasional series on definition with Dr. Beyer, last time we talked non-technical definitions, so on the flip side, let's talk technical definitions this time around. Where do we begin?
Sounds great. So there's four types of technical definition, sometimes called logical definition, and sort of let me list them in order from that which is sort of least precise, or we might say least helpful to most. Definition by accident, by property, essential definition, and definition by cause. And so today I'd like to look at the first two, definition by accident and by property.
So let's start. Definition by accident. But that sounds totally happenstance. Like, we don't even know how it happened. It just is defined.
Well,
I'm sure it's not quite the case.
Well, see, we haven't defined accident, Scott.
That's true.
But there actually is something to what you're saying. So, you know, we have that which we're seeking to define. You know, let's say dog. You know, what's the very essence or nature of the dog? Again, taking a simple example, though this can help us with more complicated concepts in our lives. And so if we say, you know, a dog is domesticated is an accident because it's not unique to a dog,
mm-hmm.
right? Cats are domesticated, lots of things are domesticated. So it's a mere accident in a slightly different sense of the word accident. But, you know, sometimes accidents are starting us on the right track to the thing's very essence. You know, like, if we say of the human being ten-fingered, well, you know, for instance, if a human being is born with nine fingers or loses a finger in an accident, like, the person is no less human. So it's accidental.
Right.
And yet, it is kind of cutting away. Well, there are animals with no fingers. There are animals with not ten fingers. Right? That's sort of just nudging us towards what the human being is. But to go back to dog, then, right, if you don't quite know what a dog is, you can start to collect multiple accidents together.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So, okay, a dog is carnivorous and domesticated. And, okay, well, does that cut away everything that's not dog? Not quite. Right. If you say, right, carnivorous, domesticated, and able to bark, like, there maybe we have actually achieved an accidental definition, because those three accidents in combination, none of them are the essential thing of dogness,
mm-hmm.
but together it at least sort of identifies what's unique to dog, though, right, it seems that in the 20th century, the Soviets actually successfully domesticated some foxes in a way that might trouble this definition by accident. But that's the great thing, right? Is sort of, if you understand definition by accident, then you're looking for a fourth accident to even cut away the, right? Sort of like, oh, you know, do those dogs all have pointy ears? Or excuse me, do all those foxes have pointy ears and dogs don't? Maybe you can find the fourth thing.
Yeah.
If you understand how it works.
I'm kind of picturing in my mind like a big giant Venn diagram, right?
So yeah, absolutely.
There are a bunch of accidents, but the dog in our case is right at the center and contains all of them.
No, that's very good. And a lot of logicians like to use Venn diagrams, and some resist them for reasons that's not worth getting into here. But I think you're right on point, Scott.
And the other one, by property. So mm-hmm. definition by property, what do we mean by that?
Yeah, so a property, and property gets defined in different ways. Sometimes A property is just that which belongs to every instance of a thing you're trying to define, like all zebras are striped. And sometimes a property isn't just common to every instance of the thing. Sometimes it's something that is unique to that thing. So that, right, human beings, for example, right, if you're trying to define what is a human being, you say, well, a human being is, you know, able to make art, is able to prepare his or her own food, is able to learn grammar, is able to argue about right and wrong. Like, those are property in the more narrow sense, because those arguably belong to every human being and only human beings always. Now, again, I can imagine the listener maybe saying, sort of, well, that doesn't belong just to human being. You know, I don't know if I even said one of the traditional properties of human being is ability to laugh. Mm-hmm. And, you know, well, the listener might say, I've been to the zoo, Dr. Beyer. You know, I've seen the chimpanzees cackling and throwing their poop. I've seen the hyenas, you know. And so there we need a definition of what ability to laugh means. Mm-hmm. I mean, I would submit that sort of what human laughter is different. So anyway, you've found this thing that's utterly unique, and you can say, okay, so man, human being, is the animal that's not a property, but sort of a general thing that belongs to man and other things. You know, human being is the animal with the ability to laugh and prepare its own food. We've got all these properties, and so that's a really good definition, because you've got these things that are totally unique to human beings.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason why it's property, as opposed to one we'll talk about next time, the essential definition, is you have this lingering sense that there's something causing that, right? That there's something behind the human ability to laugh or make art or prepare food, and these are just effects or results of something more fundamental or deeper. And so, right, it's a different type of definition altogether when you find that cause, that deeper thing. A lot of times we'll begin with a definition by property. Well, a lot of times we'll begin with accident and mm-hmm. then maybe get to property and then get to something better. And I think there's really good instances in the hard sciences where, you know, maybe an experiment will reveal something about hydrogen that's unique to hydrogen, but then it takes generations of reflection and work to find why
right.
that's the case.
We have a moment here, and as we continue through this series, we'll have one more part in this series on definition. Are we merely describing different ways to get to definition, or are we in a way working toward ways to have a better definition?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think we're kind of doing both. That is, in the various parts of the series, we've given lots of different types of definition or ways of defining that, on the one hand, is a toolbox, right? Many different ways to approach defining something. But the order of the series has suggested that some definitions are stronger than others, so that we're kind of, you know, ascending up from just kind of words and synonyms with today's visit, and then right next time we'll be at the height.
Mm-hmm.
Though, you know, as I was suggesting with the hydrogen example a moment ago, the height, it's not sort of, you know, you're having this disagreement at the dining room table and you say, let's get our terms straight, let's define so we're not talking past each other. It doesn't mean that sort of there that evening in the next 10 minutes you're gonna, you know, find the sort of the strongest definition. So it's a bit of a both and. Lots of strategies, lots of ways to define, but some better getting at the heart of the matter.
Dr. Benjamin Beyer, Associate Professor of Education at Hillsdale College, talking about definition here in our occasional series, Technical Definitions Today. Thanks for joining us, Dr. Beyer, here on the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
That will wrap up this edition of the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Our thanks to Molly Hemingway, a senior journalism fellow at Hillsdale College, senior editor at The Federalist. We talked about the current state of the media. It also previewed her upcoming book, Rigged: How the Media, Big Tech, and the Democrats Seized Our Elections. We also talked with Sohrab Ahmari, his recent book, The Unbroken Thread, Discovering the Wisdom of Tradition in an Age of Chaos, and Ben Beyer from Hillsdale's Education Department, as we talked about technical definition. The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour is recorded at the studios of WRFH, the student-run radio station at Hillsdale College. Remember, you can hear new episodes every week on this station. You also can find extended versions of some of our interviews, including our Sohrab Amari interview this week, on the podcast. Find that at SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, Spotify, or Amazon Podcasts. Search for The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour. Follow us on Twitter at Hillsdale Radio or find us on Facebook. Email us at radiohour@hillsdale.edu. To find out more about Hillsdale College, head to hillsdale.edu. Until next week, I'm Scott Bertram, and this has been The Radio Free Hillsdale Hour.
Are you enjoying the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour? Then sign up for the Radio Free Hillsdale Hour email list. Just visit radiohour.hillsdale.edu and type in your email address to receive the latest episodes with interviews of Hillsdale College professors and friends. Again, don't miss an episode and join our email list at radiohour.hillsdale.edu. That's radiohour.hillsdale.edu.
This is RC from Tobacco and Brew, bringing you this month's Cigar of the Humidor. For this month, we're reviewing Arturo Fuentes Hemingway Classic. With curves of a supermodel, this Perfecto has a superbly balanced, toothy, and attenuated Cameroon wrapper, and pairs exquisitely with a complex filler and binder that indulges the palate with citrus, coffee, cocoa, and cedar. Come down to the shop for your Arturo Fuente Hemingway Classic today, 2143 Hilltop Drive, Reading.
Hi, this is Senior Chief Rob Burrows with the Northern California Veterans Museum and Heritage Center, and I am your host every Saturday morning from 9 to 11 with Battlefield Expressions. Battlefield Expressions is where we talk about veterans issues, advocacy for our community, and those in our community who help support our veterans. Once again, join me every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, Battlefield Expressions on KCNR 96.5 at 1460 AM.
Years ago, Simpson University began with a promise to be the gateway to world service. 30 years ago, we moved to Reading with a promise to serve the North State, graduating professionals who live and serve our growing community. Today, Simpson University continues to provide a Christ-centered education, graduating students with mature and infectious faith, critical competence, and a ready spirit to thrive as servant leaders around the world and at our backyard. Learn more about Reading's hometown university at simpsonu.edu.
Good morning, Reading. This is Rick Hughes, host of The Flatline. Heard every Sunday morning on KCNR 96.5 FM at 7 a.m. in the morning. Just want you to know that God has given us two ends, one to think with and one to sit on. And success in life depends on which one you use. It's heads you win and tails you lose. Come join me on The Flatline and learn about God's tremendous problem-solving device. 7 a.m. every Sunday morning, 96.5 FM, KCNR.
Moment in History by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. Aaron Bell, nicknamed Billy Goat Bell, became the first Superior Court judge in Shasta County in 1880 and served until 1891. It was he who gave the order to move the county seat from Shasta to Reading. The first high school in Shasta County was established in Judge Aaron Bell's nine-room house at the corner of West and Placer Streets in Reading in 1899. In 1902, a new high school was completed, facing Placer Street. Moment in History by KCNR and historian Dottie Smith. To find out more about Dottie Smith, go to the Shasta County Historical Society.
You know, it can be difficult to find a trustworthy, knowledgeable, and yet affordable auto repair shop. Advanced Automotive is a second-generation, locally owned, full-service repair shop serving our community since 1993, and one of only four AAA-approved auto repair shops in the Reading area. Advanced Automotive has a goal, and it's to keep it simple to have safe, reliable vehicles for our customers and our community. Call or come by to meet the crew who is here to serve you. 244-4423 at Advanced Automotive.
When a unicorn is slain, men have destroyed again the image of beauty that they seek. Nicholas Stewart Gray.
You're listening to Writing Roots, brought to you by Aspen House Publishing.
Welcome to Writing Roots. I'm Lee Hole.
And I'm Lee Esses.
October is our favorite month because we both really like Halloween. So for this October, we decided to take on the topic of monsters, creatures, things that go bump in the night.
We have been fairly academic over the summer and much of the spring. We wanted to have a little fun with this series. So we are starting with the brightest monsters that we can think of, the wholesome, the good ones. And then we are ending with the darkest monsters of all, the scary ones. As we get closer to Halloween, we're going to have more and more fun in this regard.
Yes. So let's get into today's topic. Monsters associated with good, with light, with purity. Because monsters aren't all evil, dangerous, and out to kill us. The definition of monster is usually just kind of an unusual creature outside of the norm.
Something that's been affected by magic in some way.
And unicorns fit that definition. The oldest reference was in the 4th century AD by a Greek physician. I don't even want to try to say his name. But that physician described unicorns as a wild ass as large as a horse with a white body, a red head, and dark blue eyes. The horn was about a foot and a half long, and it was red, white, and black. There really isn't any modern description of a unicorn that fits this.
I think when it started getting associated with purity, that was when all things that were good and wholesome were also associated with the color white in Europe, versus evil was dark and black. So I think they moved it toward the white. So our traditional image of a unicorn now is closer to all white, somewhat sparkly.
That description came around in about the 12th century AD. That's when they tried to bring the mythological lore of Greek and Roman beliefs into Christianity. Here's the weird thing, though. They, at that time in the 12th century, were described about the size of a goat. So small, little things, instead of a wild ass as large as a horse.
And along with that image of purity was that a unicorn would only come to a chaste virgin.
A lot of these themes are in the old movie, Legend, that has Tom Cruise, Tim Curry, and a couple of unicorns. Weird show. But it has that kind of theme to it of unicorns are associated with sexual purity.
I mentioned the horn being sort of not only what makes a unicorn unique and sort of by definition a unicorn, but that also tends to be where a lot of the magic is held in this magical creature. And it turns out that they actually bought and sold unicorn horns at one point during medieval Renaissance time.
They were used a lot in the medieval times in alchemical pursuits as a way to cure poison, to identify poison. At least that's their belief. But what were these unicorn horns in reality?
Narwhal horns. It turns out they thought that the Vikings were particularly good at hunting unicorns because they came up with all sorts of unicorn horns. And to give you an idea of how much a horn was worth in that time period, there are records of people trading an entire castle for a unicorn horn. So the Vikings are like, narwhal horns.
They kind of look like unicorn horns.
Lop them off, bring them down. Hey guys, can I have a castle? And they did this, not once, not twice, but for 5 centuries.
Yeah, so great. So Queen Elizabeth in the 1570s had a unicorn horn. She drank out of a unicorn horn cup. And it was actually a narwhal horn. I love the history of unicorns. But it's not just in Western culture that a unicorn-type creature is associated with purity. A lot of Asian cultures have a creature similar to the unicorn. It's often called the Asian unicorn.
The news from Town Hall is brought to you on KCNR Shasta Reading by Shasta Regional Medical Center. Your life, your health, your choice. Shasta Regional Medical Center.